attuned to tidings from Hazel Khan. My guest today is Shireen Pasha, notable documentary filmmaker and head of the film department of Pakistan's National College of Arts. We sat together in Lahore after returning from South Punjab, where we'd gone to document the rebuilding and resettling of villages destroyed after the devastating floods of 2010 and 2012. In our conversation, Shireen talks about her early life, about her deep interest in Lahore's history, and her passion for that town, in which, incidentally, I was born and grew up. She then shares with us the philosophy, politics, and practice of how she makes documentary films. Here is Shireen Pasha.
I was born in what Salman Rushdie says, midnight's children. So it was the year before partition, and I was born in Delhi. Then my parents were from Punjab. My father, who was an ICS officer, and that was a very big responsible job. That's how I remember my father, always in very responsible positions and larger than life. And out of all the children in the family, we were five siblings, I was always kind of huddled somewhere out of sight but close to my father. Very often with a book from his library, and mostly map. As a child, I was very interested in maps. So I saw my father as a very special man, and I always saw him, doing something or the other, never a moment. And the moments that he had were extremely refined moments. Like, I used to appreciate his asking us end of the day that if we saw something different that day, or that we were out together on some bedding or some dinner. And what was unusual about that dinner? Was there something? And I remember as a child, to impress him, I would, look around very fiercely at everything because I would want to impress my father at the end of the day that I had noticed. Then I remember at one point saying that the waiters were wearing gloves, and he got very happy at that. I think that continued. I think whenever I get now, when I get an award or a certificate of merit or something, I always think of him. And I think that he would have been proud.
Is what you're saying is that he made you observant?
Is that absolutely.
Noticing the gloves, the powers of observation he developed, or you developed because of him?
His own stories were also on observations. Once he said that he had to choose out of 20 people who would be his stenographer. So he was interviewing them. And in the porch there was an old Chrysler. And he would ask them something about the car in the porch where they were waiting. So many of them, he said, had not even noticed that there was a car there. Some had noticed the car and the color. Some had noticed the model. And one person had even noticed the mileage that the car. So we all used to tell him, why didn't you choose the guy, who even knew the mileage? He said, no, that's none of his business. That was other people's business. And he shouldn't have noticed that.
He shouldn't have looked inside the car.
Inside the car. So he said, I made sure that I didn't get that one.
Because he might be looking inside his his business.
Yeah, it showed him something about his personality. I am a Lahori. I wasn't born in Lahore.
But you qualify.
My family are all here. My grandfather's house is here in the walled city.
So what is it about Lahore? Why are people proud to be Lahoris? Or why do they love Lahore? And there's this thing that people say. There's a long story, and Lahore is compared to all the other towns, and then somebody says, but Lahore, Lahore hai. If you could kind of talk about what the feeling is behind that phrase.
Yeah, well, historically, Lahore is a 2,000-year-old city, and it has it was on the pathway from Central Asian routes into Central India. So it was one of the big, rich cities, dazzling cities, which were on the caravan route. So the walled city of Lahore always had that very special place and stop on this Serai caravan routes. But then Lahore was also, during the later periods, a center of one of the centers of the Mughal, and certainly the capital of Punjab, already a very rich province. Punjab itself means land of the five rivers, always producing a lot of food and fruits and grains. So it was a province of plenty, you know, since ancient times. So it had, with that background, it got plundered a lot. And its riches were talked about by the plundering hordes of Genghis Khan and all the. They all aimed to get to Lahore, get the riches of Lahore, then go on to Delhi and then come back. And a lot of tribes would stop at Lahore and then go back because they didn't want to go to Central Asia and they had picked what they had from Lahore. And then during the Mughal times, although no Mughal emperor ever really stayed in Lahore for any length of time, but their governors were very important people. And the fort of Lahore is a gem. I mean, we always thought that India has got the better share of Mughal structures. But when I went to India, I thought, oh my God, I love my fort in Lahore because it has all the gems, the Shish Mahal. In the fort, yeah, there are already, you know, remarkable examples of architecture, very bold designs. Mm. And much later on, when I was doing research, and I'm still doing the research on that particular topic for a film, I realized that Lahore is being mentioned in very special ways, historically. It was always taking very bold steps, very bold decisions. Like the first white carpet was woven in Lahore. Hmm. The biggest tent called Dal Badal, mean big cloud tent. Hmm. It was so huge, and it was embroidered with real pearls. If you look at the architecture of Lahore, it's, you definitely have the feeling that there is a competition here, competition of design. Because all the, I would love to take you for a walk, you know, through Lahore, because I have my favorite areas that I stroll by.
Let's.
On a good day, let's do that, Hazel. So as you walk down, you see doorways, cornices, and since the city is built in organically, it doesn't have like straight lines. Mm-hmm. And the way those twists and turns are handled in the design is a phenomena to see. And then it acquired this makan where, you know, you step inside in a foyer and then there is a courtyard open to the sky and then there are rooms on all sides for like 3-4 stories high. So the craftsmanship of all the city is unusual, very unusual. It's functional as all good architecture should be. And Lahore, Punjab is a province with very harsh extremes of weather. It goes below zero in the winter, so houses are extremely cold. And you have these very hard, hot summers where temperatures are over 50 degrees. And then there is the monsoons, the likes of which you have never seen. It's like the sky is going to fall, you know, with the kind of water which falls in sheets. And they say if you want to know the character of a Lahori, then think about the weathers of Punjab. You know, strong, withstanding, fierce, different, and very unpredictable. Lahore was loved for its diversity in folk arts, in crafts, and whenever the Mughals wanted to retire, they wanted to retire in Lahore. Mm. And all the travelers of 12th century can tell from the time that they stayed in Lahore was always the longest. And they write in their writings details of Lahore, like Lahore had 18 types of breads. Is, you know, one of the things that I was reading. And I just, out of, you know, curiosity, I started counting how many types of breads we have today. And there were 22 types. So Lahore has consistently stayed kind of, you know, fond of food and fond of preparing food. Of course, the food was grown around Lahore. They were field. Even today, if you go out, you will see fresh fruits piled high on the streets, vegetables which are coming straight from the market. Out of this generosity and lavish scale of foods and fruits and Mughal splendor, people became generous. the hospitality was amazing. And so the Mughal princesses, they gave a lot of their pensions to building serais, which are like little hotels, so that the travelers could be able to rest in peace and their animals looked after. So one of the specialities of Lahore was its serai system.
But this idea mm-hmm. that out of abundance comes mm-hmm. generosity and hospitality rather than keeping it to yourself mm-hmm. and guarding it, they mm-hmm. shared it. Mm-hmm. And so that, you're saying, is part
Absolutely.
Of the history of Lahore, is
yeah,
this.
Yeah, and it has remained like that. That is something which has been there. And when you say Lahore, oh, but Lahore is Lahore. It's talking about the generosity of Lahore. Another thing that fascinated me was the ethnographic study of tribes within Pakistan and other provinces. I mean, everybody was living at a subliminal level and striving, you know, to live with their circumstances. And I mean, there were people living in the caves, there were people living on the waters, and for generations they would sustain themselves in amazing ways. In 1975 I joined TV, and within 2 years I had chosen to work in a desert of Punjab, and I studied the desert people there. Very rich with its traditions of music and dance, and very brave people. They survive on livestock and, you know, moving with the rains and things. So I chose that as a topic, and I made a 50-minute color documentary on 16mm. And
did it have a title?
Yeah, Cholistan Land and People. And I followed a tribe from one end to another. They were nomadic tribes. And fascinating. Mm-hmm. And the whole team stayed together for a number of months.
See, this is another thing I think that people don't understand about Pakistan. That, I mean, as a Pakistani, this is your country. Mm-hmm. And you were discovering these parts of your country. Mm-hmm. Which I think, it doesn't come clearly when with the kind of imagery and stories that are told of Pakistan. Somehow, this is what's impressed me this time around, being in Lahore, is this people just looking towards their own country to find stories rather than going elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting in the sense that we went to British schools and learned Shakespeare in our literature classes, went abroad for further studies to United States of America, and did our higher education there. So we learned to look at things in a very Eurocentric way. We knew about our literatures like Ghalib and, you know, our major writers, our major poets like Faiz Ahmed Faiz. And
from school you learned that?
From society, from our parents. Mm. But we didn't really get the kind of literatures like taught in the classrooms, you know, about our own traditions. There was somehow, colonial approach to virtually everything. The damage of that didn't seem to be overpowering at that time. I mean, my first memory is 1950s, and I was at a nursery school. But of course, we spoke our languages and we had our festivals and we all knew who we were, identities were clear. But there was a kind of a multiplicity of, knowing that this is something superior. Knowing to speak English meant that there would be more power. And so parents deliberately chose the best British schools that they could for their children.
This is WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, where Shireen Pasha, documentary filmmaker, is talking to Hazel Khan in Lahore, Pakistan. Part of the inheritance or the legacy left by the British Raj was this pretty good infrastructure of roads and bridges and language and all that stuff. But part of the legacy also is this inherent assumption that somehow non-English language culture is second class. Because the British didn't appreciate local culture, right? Or South Asian culture. Would you say, I mean, just like if you didn't speak English, you weren't quite good enough, that the culture somehow was second class because the British thought that their culture was first class?
I remember being very proud of the way we wore saris and the way we wore gararas. So it's now that we start wearing jeans and, you know, rushing, you know, all over the world with Western clothing and things like that. But at that time, it was our identities were, you know, more with our own attire and clothing. But I think that English served the purpose of connecting you with the rest of the world as a language. I think as a language, we were lucky, but I think that the best people that I met from Pakistan, in terms of languages and their proficiencies in being able to master language, were from institutions where Urdu and English were both equally taught. That if you are in a school which teaches you Urdu literature and English literature, that child has got a great opportunity at some point.
I was thinking actually about, you know, the project that you and I have just finished. We haven't finished it, but I hope we will soon. We went on the road. We went down to these villages in southern Punjab, and we made a film. Well, you made the film. I was just... One of the things, in addition to just more the more technical aspects of your profession as a filmmaker, was the idea of being a post-colonial filmmaker. And I was very interested in what you had told me and what you had on some pages of notes, that Edward Said, who had written Orientalism and who is a Palestinian in exile, who is now unfortunately no longer with us, but a very famous and important man, that he had written specifically comments about, which you interpret as a, for a filmmaker. I don't know if they were actually addressed to filmmakers.
Yeah, well, Edward Said, along with Chomsky and, you know, a host of people in the 60s, became prominent in their describing that, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, as so many countries got liberated from colonization. And it seemed freedom at that time, but it was not really in that sense free, because all the cultures just imitated what had already been happening in terms of governance and in terms of living patterns and civil service. The colonizers had not handed over the countries, you know, who would be equipped now to handle new countries with newer ways of governances, for which they had asked this freedom and got this freedom. And certainly subcontinent was left in such disarray as had never been seen before. The kind of loss of life and property. And now the more there is research on the partition and the plans of partition, it is evident that all of this could have been avoided.
Partition, you
know, between India and Pakistan.
In 1947.
In 1947. And that could have been reduced substantially, like hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands of people dying in slaughter.
But specifically in these villages, when we did the filming, and in the commentary that we developed and so on, you were very careful. The assumption that I, the filmmaker, don't need to hear your, the villager's voice when I can tell your story. Mm-hmm. That whole idea of assuming that the villagers, the indigenous people, in this case the villagers, can't speak for themselves.
Yeah, well, that was... Also, Europe had already gone through somewhat that phase where there is a commentator and his voice is superimposed upon people's voices and given priority over them. And there is this sense that there is no need to hear your voice when I can, as a compare, talk about you better than you can speak about yourself. So I will tell your story back to you in a new way, and tell it back to you in such a way that it will become mine, my own. So I will be rewriting you. I will write myself anew. And I am still an author. I am an authority. I am a colonizer, the speaking subject. And I'm still at the center of my talks.
Yeah, about you.
About
We're
you.
Talking about you, but
yeah.
I'm telling the story.
Story, yeah. So it's the subaltern voices that needs to be brought out in that sense. So layers of meaning must be considered when engaging the voices of the people.
So in the film that we made, was that in your mind when you were filming or just when you were editing or before you even started? Or
each project has to have a way that has to be thought through how we are going to approach. But some constant things that I find that I apply and I want to apply is really that we never use a alien voice in the sense that you would alienate the community or override the community's voice or interpret what somebody is saying in your tone, a tone of authority. So you need to pose questions in a different way and let the community voices exhaustively talk about themselves and to let them, describe themselves the way they see. And also that the filmmaking team portray themselves as people with no hint of any kind of pride. Pride in the sense that we are better than you. Some ethnic superiority.
That's
we could be Sayyids. And you could be Madachas. Sayyids are the children of the lineage of the Prophet, and Madachas would be people who deal with the trade and the crafts and are of a lower caste. And maybe a part of this is something which the West probably doesn't teach that way. That you already have your set of questions and somebody will sum up the problem in a question and just leave a very tiny bit left to the subject that you're addressing. And this kind of approach can be taken right through from research to post-production. So in the post-production, you would not voice over on a community voice. You would subtitle so that the community's voice never gets drowned into, somebody else who is voicing over the community voice. So the community voice you hear for a bit, but then it is lowered and it is then, you see the translation of that into another language who will then. So you get the sense that it's a more worthier language. And the power of the language that this man is speaking is voiced over, so it kind of belittles him. And you don't get to see his personality because you're not hearing him. You're hearing another sound, which is translating. So you would subtitle. Community voice you hear for a bit, but then it is lowered, and it is then, you see the translation of that into another language hopefully. But certain countries in the West don't like to read subtitles. And some countries I found in Europe, they absolutely don't want to hear the local voice being, subdued. They want to hear the voice of the person who's talking, whoever it may be, because that's part of his character. And I think that's one of the nicest things in documentaries, that you learn to deal with languages. You learn to, you know, translate and subtitle in different ways.
It's a very subtle thing that you're talking about, the voice.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a greater level of professional ethics that are being practiced now than they were. Right.
Were there any particular things that stand out to you now that we've finished the filming that surprised you or that confused you? Or, I mean, I know, for instance, I was impressed because we were filming at night and there was no electricity. So you were filming these men around a bonfire. And that must have been some kind of challenge from a filmmaking point of view. And then you used the car lights.
Yeah, well, this was now our travel plans, that we getting to this place after 8 hours drive, and then it would be evening, so what can we do in the evening? So we wanted villagers' voices recalling some of the flood when it came unexpectedly. And for that, I thought night would be better. And fire could be a symbol of hope, and it could also give us light. Fire is always so interesting to sit around a fire, and, you know, you can do many things with it. But the fire was not enough. Somehow the light that we required was not there. So we had, and there was no electricity, although we had taken our portable lights, but they needed a generator. But we had two vans. So we positioned the vans in a way that we could use its headlights, except that one van had a diesel engine and it was making a lot of noise. So we had to, you know, shut that down for a while when there used to be some audio recording situation. But otherwise it worked. And I've done this before. I've done this in deserts and in some places where there is no light and you have to film. And it worked. It really worked.
It worked very, very nicely, yeah. Mm-hmm. But literally, you didn't particularly anticipate it, but when it occurred, you knew how to deal with it.
I don't panic. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You've tried your best. There can be some other situation that can be created. Something happens. Something comes in front of you, and you just have to. The film is coming alive in your head, and you know, okay, that's it. That's going to fit in there, and that's. So it's very exciting. I think it keeps you on the edge. One doesn't get tired. And you dream about some things going wrong. I mean, you're fully into this process, from your head to your toes. Food or sleep or anything doesn't seem to matter.
So are you actually in a sort of different mode when you're filming in the field like that?
Yeah.
Than
absolutely.
You are when you're here in
absolutely.
The hall?
It reminds me of an athlete somehow who has to win a race. And he has to use every muscle in his body to be able to get there. And that's the feeling I have if I'm, you know, working with a community. But the joy of being able to stretch your mind and your body and your perseverance all in one go is also an amazing, I think, feeling to have, that you've just got this moment to think and what you can get out of it.
So you've got to catch it while you can, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you very much, Shireen.
Not at all, Hazel.
Thank you.
It was nice for you to be with us on this trip, and also that you have remembered so much of it. And
so still a million questions I'd like to ask, but thank you very much. That was Shireen Pasha, documentary filmmaker, speaking to Tidings from Hazel Khan in Lahore, Pakistan. You can see more about the making of our film, After the Floods, on my travel blog at hightidings.wordpress.com. Tidings airs on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM and is produced by Tony Ernst. More about Tidings on hazelkahn.com.